You are now listening to the Someone's Favorite Productions podcast network.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the New World Pictures podcast bonus episode. I'm Ryan. With me, as always, is Mark.
Bonus.
And Erica.
I go by Erica Trenchard Smith now.
And we are rounding out Sci-Fi July Presents Dystopian Summer 2, Dystopia Harder, with an interview with Brian Trenchard Smith, who's returning to the podcast. We spoke to him last Dystopian Summer about Dead End Drive-In. Now we're going to talk to him about Escape 2000, a.k.a. Turkey Shoot. Just really quickly want to say thank you to Brian for, yes, you know, talking with us twice. Just shows you what a great guy he is. We were so thrilled to talk with him. We are enormous fans of Brian and very kind of nervous to talk to him because he's excellent and he's an incredible exploitation director. So we were thrilled to be able to talk to him about Escape 2000, a.k.a. Turkey Shoot. He will call it Turkey Shoot. And here's us talking to Brian Trenchard Smith. I'm so jealous. Thank you for sending those pictures of the drive-in double feature of the movies that, as it happened, were released by New World Pictures, Turkey Shoot and Dead End Drive-In. That would have been a tremendous thing to go to.
It was. I mean, it's a small rural drive-in, one of the last surviving ones in Newburgh, Oregon, off the 99. And, you know, it's not paved like the drive-in I had in Dead End Drive-In was. You know, that was an amazing drive-in that I first went to in 1966. I took my father to Major Dundee at the Matraville Drive-In,
wow,
Sydney, in 1966, where we were impressed. Dad was always big on Westerns, and The Searchers was probably one of his favorite.
Yeah,
films of all time. Anyway, that was my first drive-in experience, and his, because he, as an Australian, he joined the Royal Air Force in 1930 and had therefore not been exposed to drive-ins. Though, I suppose in a way, the first movie I ever saw was projected on a sheet hung from a clothesline behind the major runway of the Air Force base that he, sorry, I'm just fending off a cat. That's right. I will be cat bombed in a moment, and because she wants to say hello to you. they are like that. I mean, there's an entire cat soap opera going on in this house between her and her sister and my wife and I and our respective relationships with the different cats. I digress. That's my final work should be the ultimate cat video.
They get a lot of hits. Gets a lot of hits.
Yeah, well, if you are aware of my Facebook page, occasionally you'll hear about my cats. You'll hear about the deer and the squirrels and the neighbors and other such things. So anyway, back to your subject.
But it's amazing that you had visited that same drive-in that you eventually then shoot Dead End Drive-In. And I think that's just an amazing kismet. I wanted to start just with a quick question about your early career, because before we jump into Turkey Shoot, it's just because you had started out making documentaries. I just wondered what was it making documentaries that you sort of took into once you switched over to making features? What was the lesson of making documentaries that you took with you?
I started as a news film cutter, which meant that a 100 feet of 16 millimeter black and white film, either with sound imprinted upon it or sound separate, or on a mag stripe or an optical stripe, that would be dumped upon you by a journalist when it came off the processor and said, right, I got a 45 second story, give me about 20 seconds of this, then give me that sound grab from such and such to such and such, and then wrap it up with whatever good shots you can find, make it look pretty, yada, yada, yada. Okay, off he goes. And so I put something together and he comes back having pre-written something. And then generally thought, oh, good. Now I'll move this sentence down to there because I like those pictures. Or you'll say, move this around. And you have it all tape spliced together and you're showing it to him on the HKS winder. Sorry, I'm giving a sort of animated version here. someone can digitally paint in the HKS on the hand winder, and me looking at the little screen there. So you have to learn, you have to work fast, you have to digest information, understand what they want. Okay, 15 seconds. Okay. And you're dealing with, you don't want to be generally less than 2.5 seconds a shot, 3 seconds, 4 seconds. And if the shot is worth it, you know, you sit there for 4 seconds. But in the business of news is get the pictures on fast. So that was initially, you know, my grounding in playing with the, you know, syntax and grammar of film in this sort of kind of rough-hewn cinema verite way. And occasionally I would be sent out with a Bell and Howell camera, clockwork wind, three separate lenses on a, you know, rotating. And when there was something unimportant like a car accident that was blocking a freeway that anyone could handle, occasionally I'd have to go and shoot that, bring it back. But it was generally... You had a slow editing morning from 9 a.m. and a fast hell for leather editing afternoon as more and more stories came in between the two main news editors. Occasionally a third documentary editor would pull off the documentary and chip in, but you had to get the whole reel made up and onto a telecine chain by 6:29 because the news rolled with the lead story at 6:30. So you learn to work fast, and I being a modest, humble young man of 20, I said to the station manager, you know, I think your promos are dull. I just come from England a year ago with a forged reference. And been taken on because I seem to be a bright young lad, and proved to be a bright young lad with a big mouth. they said, "Well, what would you do better?" I said, "I'd make them faster or make them more violent," and because I had always been interested in trailers, which I'd grew up on in England. We were going to double features in British provincial cinemas, and maybe a newsreel, a cartoon. Trailers and small feature and the main feature, and I found trailers interesting. Why did they choose that bit? So I just applied that on this occasion and said, well, I'd like to choose some bits, you know. So I made them some promos. I think the first one was for a Stanley Baker film called Hell Drivers, which you will find Sean Connery in a small part. And of course that introduced Stanley Baker to Cy Raker. Enfield, and they did Zulu together, but that's another rabbit hole. I will not disappear down here. It's worth to talk about United Artists to New World Pictures. That's right.
Right.
So a lot of flexibility too, it sounds like, which you had to be often very flexible in your movie making career.
Yes, but what news cutting and ultimately trailer cutting it taught me was to get to the point. And therefore, when you extrapolate that from the editorial process, which is meant to finalize the film, why don't you build the film from the standpoint of what you end up wanting to see? Don't write a scene, or maybe write more scenes than you need, and maybe shoot more scenes than you might need, but don't include scenes that, you know, in any way sort of slow down the picture or lessen the picture. Every scene has to contribute something valuable. So from an editorial point of view, you've got to build the script, and then the shooting day, you have to then tailor your vision to what you can afford. I've made movies in 12 days. Episodes of television in 6 days, five Silk Stalkings episodes in 6 days mm-hmm. apiece. Mm-hmm. And that's, like 10 day. Anyway, you probably know this stuff. But
we love hearing it though. Hearing all this stuff.
New World owned Silk Stockings eventually, but not, I think, at the time that you worked on it.
So who did?
New World Television.
Oh, New World. Oh, right. Yes. No. Yes, it was a Stu Siegel production, but he got a great deal with CBS, who were looking to sort of try to get away with spicing up their schedule somehow. If you made something with a bit more edge, and put it on after the 11 o'clock news and called it, crime time after prime time. and Silk Stalkings was one of the series they devised for that. I think another one's called Dangerous Curves, which was pretty much the same idea. But it was a fun show to do in San Diego, doubling for Palm Beach, Florida. going into empty, McMansions and with quick redressing and setting our characters against them and getting at $2,500 location fee a day, getting in and out like robbers' dogs, particularly if you had a hard finish, you have to be out by 7 because, the Pope is arriving or something, and God forbid that that last truck is not out at 6:59. Just the sort of practicalities of filmmaking sometimes. Anyway, we've wandered way off the path again.
Quite fine because Ryan
let me bring
and
you
I...
back to the path.
Yeah. Oh yeah, yes. There it is.
Now, I have no idea who she was, and perhaps someone could find out that she was an extra, and I would have put a camera on her, but this is just a still, a publicity still that was taken on one day. Mm-hmm. How did I miss this?
That's you're holding up the back of the slipcover of the new umbrella Blu-ray of Dead and Drive-In. The girl with the bullhorns
bullhorn brassiere.
Bullhorn brassiere. Yeah, we were wondering. We were like, where is she? I don't see her in the movie. But it's good enough.
Prototype Me Too brassiere, I think. Maybe she'd be named the Harvey Weinstein brassiere.
yes, exactly.
Keep those hands to yourself. Let's try to jump now. There's a bunch of things I'd love to ask you about. Let's keep it to the New World stuff because I'm such a big fan of a lot of your early stuff, including The Man from Hong Kong. But Turkey Shoot comes at an interesting time. Did you get that movie because of Anthony Ginnane? Is that
Anthony Ginnane? Yes.
Ginnane. Yes. Is that
I'd made trailers for Tony on a number of his early films because after persuading Channel 10 to let me make some promos, I got sort of introduced to Channel 9, who sort of stole me, and I made promos for them that were quite successful, launching the new season in 1968, the prototype shows like Star Trek. And we made our own promos for them, and Ironside and Mod Squad and stuff like that. Anyway, so a reel of my promos came to the attention of an American company that hired me to make trailers for their British division for, amongst others, Hammer Horrors, Sergio Leone's Once Upon a Time in the West, 25 or so different titles over 2 years. And therefore, when I went back to Australia at the request of my old network, and who said, come back and keep running the network promos. And I said, yes, but you have to give me programs to make, enabling me to move from promotion to production. And I moved back. And once I had got settled, I quickly started making trailers freelance. And there were films beginning to be made in Australia, including a British film with Harry Secombe called Sunburn. Anyway, I made the trailer for that, and so I've made over 100 trailers for theatrically released movies and video releases since I stopped counting after that. so that is, you may get a sense of my attitude to pace from that. Anyway, the trailers sort of ultimately led to production, which all goes back to editing and understanding the grammar and syntax of film and how you can play with the language, long and short, is something I wish to pass on to young filmmakers.
And so did Tony give you the script? Did Tony give you the script initially, or did...
You see, we had a lot of interaction over trailers for his previous films. He had asked me, he called me up when I was in LA. He called me from New Zealand and said, I have a problem in New Zealand. Would you come and maybe, if we have to make it so, take over this movie? We want to basically frighten the director back onto schedule. And
that was David Hemmings, right?
Your reputation is known. But ostensibly, you're coming in to talk about how the movie that's being shot is going to be promoted, because I've made very successful promotions for Tony for two previous films where I made a promo reel ahead of the film being finished and sometimes ahead of it being fully shot, and just culled material from 3 weeks of shooting and threw something together on 35 millimeter with duplicate negatives and got it out at a film market. And in the case of Harlequin, he did, I think, $1.2 million worth of sales on an $850,000 movie. So, we had a good working relationship, albeit underpaid on my part, but that's another matter. I enjoyed the work and always grateful to it. And now, Tony understood where I was coming from commercially, and I was actually, not all filmmakers in Australia had my particular commercial attitude, mm-hmm. And or my taste, or bad taste, depending on which way you look at it, in films. But there again, I'd love to have made a Bergman film. The Seventh Seal might have had a battle scene or two, but still have the same thing and still have mood and atmosphere and great performances. But anyway, never mind.
Might have been a little bit more exciting. So the original script, though, is set in America.
Oh, yes. Tony had a relationship with a distributor, Hemdale, and they'd had a script that they'd paid money for and they'd like to unload. So it was basically, I was a fugitive from a chain gang for 70 pages, the naked prey for the next 30. Mm-hmm. Various people have been doing their share of the most dangerous game and the naked prey, the run of the arrow, Hunger Games, Battle Royale. Anyway, and it's a tried and true formula and it works. And I'd love to do it again if I could make it clever. Whether you agree I made this one clever or not, I don't know. But something that could have been written off as a video nasty or just a plain kill picture, it somehow has sort of had a lasting following because of its politics, which are then wrapped up in good old-fashioned exploitation elements to sugar the pill, so to speak. So they had this script and called Turkey Shoot, and it was set in 1933, and we had to make it in Australia with Australian tax money. And I said, well, I think you spend an awful lot of money trying to do facsimile America 1933, albeit you need woods and a swamp, but then you build up some kind of a prison camp. Yeah, but what about if we made it more contemporary, futuristic, and made it about a turkey shoot in the future and made the villains basically a sort of Soviet style yet capitalist authoritarian regime that uses Soviet style methods against its dissidents, gulags, etc. In other words, instead of good old boys, chasing a bunch of others around the countryside and eventually getting their comeuppance, what about something more interesting and maybe more feasible? Perhaps, for 2. Well, the idea was to make it for 3.4 million. In the end, we had to do it for a cash cost of 1.6, but there was a huge above the line that had to be paid for. And eventually, the 2.6 that it eventually cost was raised. Took me a while to get paid.
It took you a while to get paid.
But well, I said, Tony, I'll be a good soldier up to a point, and when I get starting to get annoyed, I'll let you know. And at a certain point, I started to get annoyed, and he paid me. Or he put in a program of payments and hired me for a bunch more trailers, and said, "We'll do more together," and we did. And I thank Tony from the bottom of my heart for giving me Turkey Shoot and for giving me the Siege of Firebase Gloria, which he obviously felt I deserved after what I achieved with Turkey Shoot,
which once you start going into production, the money, the budget is cut drastically. And
yes,
can you briefly talk about the Australian tax incentives and how that changed?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think it's all been fairly well documented, but during the time between when the funds were, being raised and the funds being delivered from the investors, the government changed the rules, which made a number of investors say, "Wait a minute, now we're getting less than benefit than we thought." Still a pretty generous benefit, 133% or something, 120%, whatever, depending on the categorization. But so suddenly, money that was expected didn't show up, and it became quite clear that it wasn't going to show up in time for the shoot. So the shoot had to be tailored to what we had. So what had been thought of as certainly a 36-day shoot was going to come down to 30. And then when I managed to, and that meant cutting the first 15 pages of the script and 4 pages thereafter, because the helicopter chase couldn't be afforded and the actor wanted too much money. So his function had to be given to other characters with fast rewrite before we shot. Anyway, it was hanging on to a bit of a runaway train, but the important thing was to hang on and just shoot stuff every day. What have I got? What makes sense? There are some scenes that I've always felt very happy about, the parade ground scene. If you've only got 70 people, that's the way to use them. And the scene emotionally works. Oriana Pinozzo, being beaten to death by Roger Ward in a scene that is sort of darkly comic, but still horrible and still underlines the author's message, let's say.
Was Filmco the one that was in charge of the funding? They handled the funding, did they not?
Yeah, I think so. They are credited as such. I knew those guys. They all seemed to be very pleasant, and they liked me. They knew it was a film made under difficulties, and they knew that I took I diverged more into high camp horror. They realized I had, as a way of making the most out of the resources we had. We didn't have a proper Alf. We could have had a cyborg Alf. It wouldn't have been full Furiosa, but it would have been, there could have been an interesting prosthetic and, various things, but that whole chunk of the makeup budget had to go. So, we could afford hair and strange eyes,
What was it, you talk about the beginning, you had to cut the beginning part. What was it about that opening 15 pages that made it too expensive to shoot? Was it just because of the amount of locations?
It was a chase action scene that caused the three people in the van, prisoners, to be caught. Now, we get that in flashback, which we quickly whipped up in dialogue. And and I, on the very last half afternoon, knowing they were suddenly going to shut the picture down at the end of the 28th day, because I had officially shot every page of the script, not necessarily every page I was going to try and plug some of the gaps with.
I
sent Kerry Rossell, my second unit, my stunt coordinator, to say, I say, please take Olivia Hussey and your and Glenn Boswell, one of our lead stuntmen, great guy, to this jewelry shop and shoot with the B camera and shoot the arrest of her and get that started. I will shoot me doing Steve Railsback's underground resistance broadcast, and then I'll be one of the guards that'll slug him, and then I'll get back and jump between these two things. And therefore, we plug those two interesting character background pieces last afternoon, which I didn't realize was happening until that morning. So that's emergency filmmaking for you.
That goes back to your news days right there. That's just grabbing the camera and going.
That's right.
I have to, from a certain degree, appreciate the producers being that on top of it. That the last day of the shooting a page on the script, they were like, "That's it, we got it all, we're good to go."
Producers are on top of it every day, though. They, there's a daily progress report. What was the screen time achieved? There's a YouTube thing on the first day of shooting of Dr. No, which I just saw. Very interesting. They work through how every shot was done, which take was chosen, what held things up. And the interesting thing about it was Jack Lord was meant to be there from the beginning of the day to be integrated into the airport sequences. And of course, he didn't turn up. And very late in the day, he turned up and they managed to grab some stuff for him. Therefore, they were half a day behind and he had to plug all the gaps the next day. The director, a wonderful guy. But this YouTube thing walks you through how he did it and how he went back and restaged something for that would then glue things in better and got it all done. And so, it's the nature of things that a director has to think on his feet. And sometimes it makes it better. And that is the argument about the opening of Turkey Shoot. In fact, it is a better opening that really helps give you, even though the footage is dated, it gives you contemporary political relevance to dissidents and how they are treated. Fate actually worked for me. It's funny how things turned out. But what I had written was basically, I'd written the film to be 1984 meets the camp on Blood Island, and then they play the most dangerous game, the Naked Prey, etc. So suddenly 15 pages had been devoted to 1984 and a bit of world building, which then gets shoved into Michael Craig's speech addressing the dissidents.
Right. Which he had a hand in writing, correct?
He did. He knew my problems right from the start. and I said, Michael, help me out here. You can carry the exposition in a very interesting way that is character building. So, we are both lefties. Go for it. He did, and good for him. And I understand he is still with us in his 90s. Somewhere on the northern peninsula of Sydney. Great guy. And, a great actor. And I can remember seeing him on the screen in my local movie theater in Odiham in Hampshire in England in 1955 in a thing called House of Secrets. I have somehow a memory for all sorts of arcane movie trivia, but I know it stuck in my memory, but not that he did, but it stuck because it was in Eastman color, which was a new, cheaper than Technicolor process. And you didn't see many color films in England in the early 50s. Well, certainly I was nine by then. I hadn't seen many films, but I always remember that title. And then later I found out, oh, Michael Craig was J. Arthur Rank payroll. He was one of on the star roster. He was star of House of Secrets. So there you go. Now, most of your viewers have switched off by now.
No, not at all. Now, speaking of the cast, though, in your book, Adventures in the B-Movie Trade.
How nice of you. Yes. I carry one with me all times, rather like politicians carry the Constitution.
That's right.
Love it.
You talk about how there was some issues for the movie you were talking about a little bit earlier, Race for the Yankee Zephyr, which you were potentially going to take over directing if David Hemmings couldn't get things in order. But they had issues, or Australian Actors Equity had issues with the international cast. But you have quite the international cast for Turkey Shoot. Did they have any issue with that?
Well, they did. They always have issues with it. I even had issues with me having Thomas Jane to match John Cusack in Drive Hard.
Which is the
last film that I made before I was,
The last film
we had to fight to get him the visa to get Thomas Jane in time. And sure, I know an Australian actor might have done a wonderful job against John Cusack, but frankly, the chemistry those two guys have in the film is one of the good things about the film.
They're having a very good time in that film.
And I made sure they did. We all had a good time because we all knew that this thing had been thrown together very quickly. Someone was going to make a lot of money out of it. and so I want to make sure he was happy.
Yeah. But you're saying so even today, there are released to 2014 or 2013 when Drive Hard was made, they're still having a difficult time with international
cast. Yeah, because they felt that Australian actors, there'd been sufficient number of Australian actors who'd built up an international reputation for their to have box office value, and therefore choose one of them and don't choose an actor, a foreign actor that the existing foreign import feels he will have a particular chemistry with in this relationship upon which the entire picture depends.
Right.
Yeah.
So was Steve Railsback, was he already cast when you came on, or was
Him? Yes. Well, the concept was being pre-sold at the American film market, and the upcoming Oscars had nominated Railsback and the stuntman and Diana Scarwid from Mommy Dearest. Mm-hmm. And suddenly, suddenly market-driven casting offers went out to Railsback and to Scarwid, because they were both nominated. And so we could say at the AFM, we have in the cast two Academy nominees who might get it, and look how much the value of the picture will rise at that point in time. And all of that is fine until one of them says no. So Diana Scarwin says, are you fucking joking? Or probably maybe her agent said that. I don't know. But the general
sentiment was there. Was that? Yeah.
And she was quite right. I mean, she was on her way up. She was looking for acting challenges. The script was not written necessarily with a great affection for women, and so even though it. Yeah, it might obviously have messages in that regard, but there's nothing in the part. You get to run around and be shot at and be victimized. So naturally, she said no. Naturally, quickly. Now they had to quickly do bait and switch. And so some bright spark thought, well, what about Olivia Hussey? She's still got a great profile. And I think she may have had some media prominence at that time. So, and luckily she said yes. She was an absolute darling girl. I loved working with her. And I knew she was doing it under sufferance. She needed some money, and as we all do. So I tried to make things as minimally uncomfortable for her as possible. I body doubled her in the assault scene, would the film have failed without a close up of another woman's breasts? No, I don't think so. So, it's something that, it was not a creative decision that I'm proud of, but it was the kind of creative decision that filmmakers in that genre were, you could say, blame someone else, obliged to make, but also we were guys in a, and hopefully the toxicity of our culture has improved, shall we say.
But that was common of the time, right? I mean, that was...
I know, but others would say that's no excuse.
Sure, absolutely. And rightly so. But that was the expectation of the time. And certainly, if you're making that for... I don't know if you're making it. You're making it for international audience, obviously, but certainly for Australia. And Australia was at that time coming out of the 70s, and there was a lot of sex comedies and a lot of nudity that was coming out of that. So,
this was the breakdown of censorship. The end of Victorian repression, and I was all for it because it was easier to get girls. What I'm saying is, sexual liberation actually, has its drawbacks, as we're all finding out.
Yes, yes.
But,
100%. There's liberation and then taking things too far, right?
I think I've done enough mea culpa here. Everyone is cringing. It was a sign of the times, and I would not make that film, that way. I would not do some of the scenes, let's say, in those exploitation films that I would today that I did then. But I'm pleased with those films.
Yeah.
I think they're a sign of their times, and therefore should be examined.
Yes, we agree with that 100%. For the record, we love Turkey Shoot. I love Turkey Shoot. I think it's a great movie.
The audience at the drive-in really loved it too. They honked their pleasure at each new excess. The burning of the boy left them silent, which is meant to.
Well, yes. And,
it is a great shift moment. In tone.
It's going to happen.
Really puzzles people. Mm-hmm. But every now and again, I like to do that.
Yeah,
of course.
It's a bit meta. Mm-hmm. It's a bit pointing, at the artifice to do such a gear change, and then expect you to go back and have fun with it.
Yeah, it's effective.
Why not?
You've said that it was like that. Turkey Shoot, like the international audiences, particularly American audiences, understood it. Australia, not so much. It was not as big a success, was right?
It was a big success in the drive-ins. And it got miraculously initially rated M. I think maybe the member of the Australian Censorship Board must have gone out for a pee or something. I don't know. and missed some of the good bits. But the British censor didn't, and he attacked it savagely. And there's somewhere in the files of the British Board of Film Censors my rebuttal to their cuts as to why. And it did get some of them, put back, which was good. But they put a couple of things back because they understood, they sort of grasped the politics. I think they were so sort of shocked by the film, they hadn't sort of grasped the politics. And also they were conservatives.
Sure. So maybe they didn't love all the messaging that was going on in it.
No.
But, and they maybe missed Steve Rackford getting chopped in half. And
something like that. Yes. anyway, look, it's fun. Yes. We had fun that day with filling him with leftover lunch items and tomato ketchup.
It's like leftover sausage, right? From that you were eating that day.
There was sausage and steak, but there were leftover bits of steak. There was. I wanted to see a little bit of a T-bone, a bit of a bone jutting. I don't know whether, but you know, I had to get it done. You know, sometimes.
Right.
Today I would refine the pack shot.
Like yes.
And he cut that tree so that he could be inside the tree in order to for the, you know, the bulldozer to come up right to his legs. Yeah. Right.
Yeah, we had a fake section of a tree. You see. Yeah, we had, yeah.
So great. Such a great. I mean, you can. I feel like a lot of movies they would do that digitally rather than ahead and make a practical tree, which is what makes sells that moment, as far as I'm, in my humble opinion.
Yeah. Yeah.
But so the movie comes out in 1982, Turkey Shoot, does not come out in America till 1983. Was there no American distributor that was at all thinking about picking up the movie until New World picked it up?
I think sometimes it takes a little while to filter through the pipeline. Firstly, Hemdale didn't like it because they had the international sales rights. You know, it was a nice little round robin for them. You know, piece of goods that had cost them $100,000 got made at someone else's expense, and then they get the distribution revenue for it. That's clever.
That's
funny. Okay.
Let me write that down. Hold on. What is this?
Yeah. How can we do that? How can pull distribution? That off?
Yeah. Well, that's fine. It's all, yeah. And, you know, obviously they shared, you know, revenue with the producer, but it was never declared profitable. Funny about that.
Yeah, that's anyway. Funny.
Yeah. Anyway, but there you go.
So they didn't believe in it, so they weren't really looking maybe very hard, you're saying, maybe for an American distributor, and then New World.
Oh, no, everyone's looking very hard for an American distributor because that's half the world. So, you know, as soon as it could be exposed, I finished the sound mix. Just before Christmas, I think, of 82. You see, anyway. Well, it just took a while to filter in, but it was certainly what Roger Corman was looking for, and he, you know, was acquiring a lot of product, wanting to eventually sell the company, and, you know.
Yeah, he had sold the company at that point. I'm not sure. Was he involved in the sale of it? Because the new owners, that he sells it in the top of 83, and the new owners were looking for, you know, movies to release in that time. Yeah. But Corman was still there as a consultant. So did you know if he was...
No, I think it was released in 83. And I believe the gross film rental was over $1 million.
Wow.
So I doubt if Corman paid more than, you know, maybe he picked it up for 50. Maybe he picked it up for 100, or maybe he picked it up outright for 250. I don't know. And then owned it for the duration. But I don't think, you know, he didn't own it in perpetuity. It didn't travel. Anyway, so.
I don't think he has. He doesn't have the, or New World, the new owners carried on. I don't think they continue to have the rights to it.
Well, no, they sold it to another entity. They sold the whole library, including, I think Turkey Shoot somehow went in a different direction. It was the library that Dead End Drive-In is in that got sold to the makers of the Underworld series, who in turn sold it to Village Roadshow.
Yeah.
Anyway,
I think they're all at Village Roadshow at this point, but.
Yeah.
But
we've released this Australian version comes from the original producer or surviving producer. So this is the first time anyone in the world has seen the version 6 minutes longer, 6 minutes of more Australian dialogue and stuff happening. No action. Well, yeah, I think there's a little action, but basically it's character and world building, and it does a lot to enhance the racial subtext.
You're talking about Dead End Drive-In there. And yeah, when New World picked it up, they retitled it Escape 2000. And then there were some cuts that were done there because there's a shorter version that was released in America than the, I think, the
82 minutes, I believe. Well, they may have cut some of the somewhat arch dialogue in the early scenes establishing the, you know, the civil servants and the celebrity hunters. They may just think, oh, those are awful performances and they've got strange, funny voices. We like the guys who speak with the English accents better. I don't know. But that was certainly the attitude with Dead End Drive-In. They wanted to eliminate Australian slang. But in Turkey Shoot, I think they just wanted to get to the chase. They wanted to get to the violence as soon as possible.
Sure.
And who needs to know who these people are? We just want to see them killed. Good commercial reasoning, I guess. Marketing department.
Were you involved?
No, I was not involved at all. I was appalled at the fact that it got cut like that. I do believe I have an original American VHS, but I have never been able to bear to watch it.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense.
Yeah. And the film was absolutely vilified by the press, and therefore the cast were embarrassed by it. So you get some of their interviews on the Blu-ray. Now,
yes.
Other members of the cast, like Roger Ward and Steve Railsback, have always embraced it.
Hmm.
Yeah.
He had Steve had a hard time understanding the cut to the budget. That was still a very difficult thing for him.
But yes.
Yeah.
Well, yes, he didn't understand the tax system and how films are made on funny money. Because most films are not profitable, unfortunately. I try to make films that are profitable or that people have determined they need to spend this amount of money to make something for their library. Mm-hmm. And whether they should have done will depend really upon how much they sell that library for when the churn turns.
And that's it.
I feel like we are all Trenchard Smiths now. Smiths. Well, maybe not me. I think that probably the pronunciation of it.
I think you need to get more entrenched into the Trenchard Smiths.
Yeah, that's right.
Thank you. Yeah. Yep.
Then you'll get it. You'll get it. You know what? I think I'm on the Turkish Shoot side of life right now. I think that's where I am. Yeah.
Always look on the Turkish Shoot side of life.
Yeah, that's what I'm calling my midlife crisis.
Oh. My Turkey Shoot. I'm in my Turkey Shoot era.
Do you see he bought a new convertible? Yeah, he's got that Turkey Shoot going.
Yep. Why did he put that bulldozer thing on the front? I don't know. Just let it happen.
Put the bulldozer on the front of his car. He put the bucket.
Oh. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Very fair. Very fair. Just the bucket.
We hope you enjoyed this interview with Brian Trenchard Smith. Thank you again to Brian. If you want to hear more episodes, you want to catch up with the rest of Sci-Fi July Presents Dystopian Summer 2, Dystopia Harder, go to our website, newworldpicturespodcast.com. That's where you can listen to all of our interviews, episodes, read our articles, buy a t-shirt that helps support the show, or you can write a 5-star review or tell a friend. Gather them around your phone and say, listen to this. And we'll see you next time on the New World Pictures Podcast, part of Someone's Favorite Productions Podcast Network. Bye, everybody.
Always look on the Turkey Shoot side of life.
Thank you for listening. To hear more shows from the Someone's Favorite Productions podcast network, please select the link in the description.
The audio commentary. It's a dying art form, but here at One Track Mind, I, your wonky yet affable host, Ryan Luis Rodriguez, analyze film through the prism of these embryonic forms of podcasting, one audio commentary at a time. Masterpieces, crapsterpieces, live action, animation, cult classics, films literally no one has ever heard of. No track is too small and no track is too big. Join me and my guests from the entertainment world as we keep these features alive every other Tuesday. Hey, who else is going to discuss Bill and Ted's Bogus Journey one week and Citizen Kane the next? Us, that's who. Sure, you have to put up with my voice, but there's a certain give and take in this industry. That's One Track Mind, part of the Someone's Favorite Productions family, and available wherever you get your podcasts.